I don't know how you feel about our politicians. You might think they're paid pretty well. They earn well over twice the average wage in Australia. Their pay is frozen, I'm talking federal pollies, at the moment. And given the current economic climate, pay rises for them wouldn't go down well. But if we did pay them more, much more, would we get better politicians? That's our topic in Rise Side Economics today with Professor Andrew Lee from the Australian National University. Hi, Andrew.
Good morning, Richard.
Is there any evidence to suggest that we'd get better politicians if we paid them more?
Surprisingly, there is a smidgen of evidence. We have a couple of neat studies, one which looked across governors in the US whose pay varies markedly, and found that governors were much more likely to match the ideology of their citizens, in other words, be a good server of their community if they were paid a little more. And then a recent piece of research coming out of Brazil, which exploited the fact that Brazilian local members of parliament, the salaries were capped, and so you got this sort of almost random variation across Brazilian municipalities. And places which paid their local politicians more seemed to get more educated candidates, more skilled candidates, and even more women running for office.
Right, okay. The thing about governors that occurs to me in the US is that there's such, I mean, they all, it sounds like the same job, but I mean, it's massively different, say, running California or New York to running North Dakota, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. So what this study's trying to do is it's trying to look at variation in salaries within states. So when some states increase the salaries of their governors a lot, do they get better governors in as a result of that? So this is one of those areas where we don't have super strong evidence. We don't have any kind of terrific random variation. But what little we have seems to suggest that if you pay more, then you get better people, which is, you know, at odds with, say, what... There's a famous Max Weber line, either one lives for politics or one lives off politics. So Weber was very worried that if you paid more, you'd get the kinds of people who want to live off politics. And that doesn't seem to be borne out in the data.
Well, Australian federal backbenchers earn around, I think it's $127,000 a year plus their allowances. It's well over twice the average wage, not three times it. It doesn't sound too bad.
It's not bad. My friends tell me that you can probably, if you put in the travel allowances and the electoral allowances, you can probably add another 50 onto that. So that would take them over three times the average wage. But it's still less than we used to pay them at Federation. So at Federation, we paid politicians about five times the average wage.
Right, that is interesting. Now, look, the Singaporeans, they pay their politicians a lot. I think they're the highest paid in the world. What's the rationale there?
So the Singaporean notion is that the most important job in the country ought to be running it, and so I think the salary of Singapore's Prime Minister is something in the order of $3 million.
It's completely US, off, I think, yes.
Indeed, yeah, completely off the charts for developed countries. So, for example, Barack Obama gets about $400,000, a little more than Kevin Rudd on $330,000, but that's the kind of ballpark for a leader of an advanced economy if you're not running Singapore.
They are. I mean, they pride themselves on being, you know, foreign policy in particular realists. This is a country which is in a strategic location but has no natural resources at all. It's all about their human capital, isn't it?
There is. My guess is the Singaporeans have probably gone a little far. It's not clear to me that at some point you can't keep on getting big enough payoffs to make it worthwhile as you steadily increase Singapore's salaries. And, you know, let's face it, the person who's running Singapore now is the son of the last person who ran Singapore. So it's not obvious that you're opening up the talent pool to the entire society.
So you're not convinced that paying that much works that well.
There's got to be diminishing returns for this, as in anything. So you know, I expect that if we paid more for economists and radio announcers, the people sitting in our seats would be of higher calibre. But if we took those salaries into the seven figure range, I'm not sure that the listeners and readers would be getting value for money.
Well, can I just urge that anyone in enormous power in the ABC who's listening now and wants to try that out? Please feel free to do so. I'm quite happy to cop a seven-figure salary, if only to do an experiment for Andrew.
Now, that's very good of you.
Yes. Politicians generally don't do it for the money, do they? They have other reasons.
They do, though you can clearly see when you chat to people who are considering public office that they're aware of the salaries that are going to be paid, and that they're aware they're giving up a fair bit. And you know, this is a challenge for judges as well. So going in to a job which is going to put you in much more of public limelight, often involve longer hours than the job you've currently got. If it also involves a substantial pay cut, that may make some talented people think twice about it.
If you are a cabinet minister or cabinet minister material, it's a fair bet you could earn more in the private sector, though.
I think that's right, and that's almost certainly the case for many of those who've come from the corporate sector, which, you know, for example, tends to be more the case in the conservative side of politics in most places.
Mm. If we start paying politicians more, would that attract people who are in it for the money?
This is the sort of bees to the honeypot kind of theory. It's certainly something we ought to worry about. My read of the little evidence we have is that's tended not to be the case. You've gotten, for example, more educated people and people whose ideology reasonably well matches the citizenry. So it seems like that's okay. The sort of thing I mean, we're often very concerned about this sort of notion of the fox guarding the hen house, that we oughtn't let politicians set their own pay. But there's a reverse concern, which is that politicians are also often tempted to grab the limelight with a showy freeze of their salaries, or the substantial cutbacks to the parliamentary superannuation scheme a couple of years ago.
Mm.
I think that does have a sort of long-term effect on the kinds of people who are willing to run for public office. So, you know, Kevin Rudd does reasonably well on $330,000, but if you rank him against Australia's CEOs, he's 440th, just ahead of the CEO of The Reject Shop.
Yes, and actually paid substantially less than many of the people who work for him. I'm thinking about, you know, the Chief of Defence Staff, the heads of government departments, that kind of thing. On Life Matters today, my guest, we're doing Ryside Economics with Professor Andrew Lee from the ANU. We can find out how wealthy our politicians are by looking at the Register of Pecuniary Interests. Apart from Malcolm Turnbull, who, of course, took an enormous pay cut to become a politician, and the Prime Minister, who's married to a very successful businesswoman, are they generally wealthier than the rest of us?
Well, so the best way of finding this out is to go to a website called Open Australia, which is a terrific team, a non-partisan team, which has gone through the pecuniary interest registers and scanned and put up on the website in PDFs all of the pecuniary interest returns of Australian politicians. And the thing that strikes me when I go through them is that Australia's politicians don't seem particularly wealthy, particularly out of the ordinary. The typical Australian politician tends to have one house, a mortgage, and a superannuation fund. Not a lot of shares. Some of them have a second house, many of them don't. So it's quite different, for example, from what you get in the US, where those who are running for office tend to be much, much wealthier than the typical American, and generally have a net wealth at least of seven-figure range. There are, I think, relatively few millionaire politicians in the Australian Parliament.
Where they do better, and you've already mentioned super, is in the superannuation. It's pretty generous. Does this encourage them to stay on longer, perhaps past their best before date?
It certainly does. There's a neat little experiment that they do. Well, it's not meant to be an experiment, but it turns out that way in the US, where there's an incentive to stay on from 1990 to 1992. You get a huge increase in pensions because of a quirk in the law. And a large number of American politicians run for office rather than retiring in the 1990 election, and then a disproportionate number retire in 1992. I think we've got our own little natural experiment going, which is that it used to be the case that you needed to stick around for 8 years in order to get that pension, which was worth about 50% of salary. Following the Mark Latham-inspired scrapping of that in 2004, there's no longer such a strong incentive to stick around for 8 years. So my guess is we're now going to see a little bit more turnover in Australian politics than we did in the past. You know, maybe that's a good thing, but it's certainly the case that we didn't compensate the new politicians for the fact that the overall financial benefits of going into politics are lower now than they were in the past. You get a salary which is, as you say, a little more than twice average wages, but you don't get a particularly generous pension, and you're strongly in the public limelight.
Interestingly, when he retires, Peter Costello is going to get more money than he's getting now, because at the moment he's on a backbencher's pay, and his super goes up. His super will be substantially more.
I think it was Peter Martin who made this point,
yes,
wasn't it?
And yeah.
Yes, it's a delightful one, and one of those sort of odd quirks of the system, which again creates retirement incentives to stay for 8 years, but at a certain point creates incentives to get out of the game.
I wonder if there's a case for paying politicians more in order to, as the research seems to suggest, get better politicians, but not give such generous super. Although it has to be said, Peter Costello is the beneficiary of the arrangements that were in place before the law changed, as well as those since.
Yeah, I mean, I would be inclined to think that that we ought to pay politicians more while in office. And the other thing about that is potentially then you're able to crack down, for example, on people who are doing consultancies and outside work while they're politicians. It's not clear to me that politicians ought to be running two jobs in the current
yes.
economy, but it's certainly the case that some of them are doing that, and you can much more justifiably crack down on that if you raise the salary a little. I don't think it's going to be a popular reform, but I think it would probably pay off in the long run.
This is a very live issue in countries where there are high levels of political corruption, and in much of sub-Saharan Africa, for example, although not all of it. And there is a Sudanese-born British entrepreneur called Mo Ibrahim who's been trying to do something about this.
So the Mo Ibrahim Prize, I think, is a terrific notion. Essentially, he's a mobile phone entrepreneur, and he decided he wanted to do something to improve governance in sub-Saharan Africa. His idea was to create a prize for a leader who steps down democratically, and that prize is a $5 million initial payment and then $200,000 a year for life. So it's, they say, the biggest prize in the world, certainly much bigger than the cash value of the Nobel Prize. And Mo Ibrahim says, you know, when you're in a developed country, a leader steps down from office, they go onto the speaking circuit, they get onto the consulting circuit, they take a job for a merchant bank, and their retirement is assured. But for many African leaders, they know they're going to be poor in retirement, so there's more of an incentive to steal a little bit more while in office. I think it's a clever idea. I don't think it's going to solve all of Africa's problems, but it's certainly got to make some contribution towards it.
Interestingly, the first winner was the former leader of the country that is arguably best run in Africa, and that is Botswana.
Yes, exactly, and the second from Mozambique. So there's, it's early days, but I think it's a clever notion, trying to put cash on the table for guys who do the right thing.
Andrew, thanks. Always interesting. Talk to you in a fortnight.
Thanks, Richard. Ciao.
Andrew Lee is Professor of Economics at the Australian National University. And well, what do you reckon? Should we pay politicians more? I wouldn't have a problem with it, but as Andrew said, he suspects there's a political issue with doing it. Perhaps cut back their super, pay them more, pay them more and stop the expenses, because expenses are obviously the bit that's easier to rort. Head for the guestbook, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters.